No. Okay, wait a minute.
Let's go down and say names. Just starting with Bob.
Bob, Tom, Jim.
Jim.
Eric.
Eric.
Shogai.
Shogai.
James.
James.
David.
David.
Debbie.
Debbie.
Frankie.
Frankie.
Pat.
Pat.
Mark.
Mark.
Shintai.
Shintai.
Sophia.
Sophia.
Robin.
Robin.
Dave.
Dave.
Shoketsu.
Shoketsu.
So I have a few announcements here. Next Saturday, the 22nd, is the book group here at 10 o'clock. And I think most of you know that those people who are interested in it are on the list. We're reading the Homeless Kodai.
Kodo.
Right.
And it's short essays, so have no fear of coming in the middle if you're interested.
And we usually have books here, so you can just drop in and share books. The following Saturday, no, it's not the following Saturday. Saturday, July 13th is our community potluck, and it's basically going to be a summer party. It's going to be, instead of our regular noon, it's going to be at 6 p.m. at a member's house. It's going to be at Myoju's house, also known as Bella. So that's going to be fun. We bring our own, we bring vegetarian potluck.
Do we need to RSVP for that, or can we just show up?
Either way, we can just show up. Especially if you're a priest.
Thanks, I'm not welcome.
No. And then the big thing coming in August is the Y East Brightways End Sesshin, which is August 20th through 25th. That's a Wednesday through Sunday. So it's going to be fun. It's going to be at Camp Yamhill, out in Yamhill. And also, my kind of thing is I'm looking for openers, closers, and guest masters, people who want to do that. I assign those, so let me know if you can do that.
It's a good way to get yourself to come.
Yeah. Yes.
You just got to come, you know, rather than you wake up and you're like, I don't know, it's a nice day. What if you're signed up? Sometimes I look around the Zendo and I'm like, almost everybody's here had to be.
So let me know if you're interested and I will add you to the calendar. You usually don't have to do it very often. The more people we have, the fewer times you have to open or close or be guest master, which is basically you're being the host.
So if you open, you get here half an hour early. If you close, it's usually maybe about 20 minutes extra at the end.
And usually it's two people closing, so it makes it back go a little faster.
Right.
Thank you.
All right, so we will be starting our Dharma Talks formally and ending formally, except I forgot to end formally the last time.
Oh,
just, because I was just kind of like, well, all right. I mean, so we got some habit energy to get over, but... So when this is, I don't know, poor Bob, he records this stuff and he's got to put it on the website. Is it a Dharma talk? Is it a discussion? Is it a class? I don't know. Sometimes the distinctions are kind of strange, but a Dharma talk is kind of when one of the teachers just offers an original, we're not just reading from something or presenting teachings in a kind of class setting we're offering.
So I wanted to mention that some of us get together at Market of Choice after this, so I'll head over there, and we usually meet upstairs, and anybody who's interested can join us. They have food, and you just get your own food, check it out at the check stand, and meet upstairs, and we have a little conversation. Sometimes people just have coffee and a cookie, but I just wanted to mention that.
Thank you.
So we'll head out after that today, so.
And I don't know about what your experience is, but Sangha, I don't know. That has been at least as important an aspect of Sangha to me as the friendships that I've made over time than any of the other stuff.
I suppose I can't say, and we try to do that every Sunday. Sometimes people are irregular in their attendance, and that's fine. It's not one you have to sign up for. You just show up.
Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. So, today I am continuing with going through my recently created 9 fields of Zen practice. I forgot to bring copies of the 9 fields of Zen practice for you to refer to, but we've already gone through, in the course of Dharma Talks, Zazen, Dharma study, cultivating insight, precepts, and opening the heart. And if you're interested in this, my presentation of this as trying to live a comprehensive view of practice, all the different aspects that it can have. And if you're curious about it, it's on my podcast website, so there's little cards for zenstudiespodcast.com, and under, I think, resources, I have a link to 9 fields of Zen practice. Today, then, the next field is connecting with the ineffable. So, this is one of the reasons that I formed the 9 fields, was that I felt like sometimes there were areas of practice which can be neglected, that they're a little more difficult to get your hands on or mind around, and I think this is one of them. So I'll just state that from the beginning. It's kind of hard to get your mind around what exactly this field of practice is. So the word ineffable describes something you can't convey in words. Generally because it is too great, profound, subtle, mysterious, emotional, wonderful. It has a positive connotation. Now, Zen is not based on a belief in God in a theistic sense. However, at its core is a strong emphasis that reality is much more profound, inspiring, significant, hopeful, luminous, whatever, many different ways to describe it, than it may sometimes seem to us in our daily lives. Sometimes, you know, depending on how our life is going, but certainly there are many people in the world, you know, who are experiencing life as being very, very bleak and hopeless and mundane and discouraging. Now, when giving a Dharma talk, I usually try to be conscious of not, you know, being a real bummer. But, you know, our society has a great many problems, despite of all the wonderful things in life and all of the blessings that we have. You know, suicide, depression, anxiety, addiction, which, you know, is a huge problem right now. Fear and hatred of the other. Spiritual disconnect from the natural world. And sometimes I just, when I'm talking about this topic, I look up on the the Association for Suicide Prevention website. 2017, suicide was the 10th leading cause of death for Americans. In 2017, there was an estimated 1,400,000 suicide attempts. You know, this is a really big deal. This is, you know, that most of the time, most of the time, we can feel okay and all is well, but that's a huge amount of despair in the world. And sometimes, you know, we'll have experienced that at times ourselves.
So this is one of my favorite books, Why Religion Matters by Houston Smith. And this is a sweet way that he starts to convey why it is maybe perhaps part of the reason that there is this darkness and despair in the world. He says, Bertolt Brecht is best remembered for his plays, but critics consider his poems more profound. The relevant one here is titled To Those Born Later. Truly I live in dark times. The innocent word is folly. An unlined forehead suggests insensitivity. The man who laughs just hasn't heard the terrible news. Stephen Dunn is less well known, and the style of his poetry is different. In its own way, however, it too works to pull the contents of this chapter together. So I shall quote, at the Smithville Methodist Church. So some of you will have heard me read this. I believe it was 2.5 years ago when I gave my Dharma talk on Imo, the Ineffable, Dogen's chapter on this. It was supposed to be arts and crafts for a week, but when she came home with the Jesus Saves button, we knew what art was up, what ancient craft. She liked her little friends. She liked the songs they sang when they weren't twisting and folding paper into dolls. What could be so bad? Jesus had been a good man, and putting faith in good men was what we had to do to stay this side of cynicism, that other sadness. Okay, we said, 1 week. But when she came home singing, Jesus loves me, the Bible tells me so, it was time to talk. Could we say, Jesus doesn't love you? Could I tell her the Bible is a great book certain people use to make you feel bad? We sent her back without a word. It had been so long since we believed, so long since we needed Jesus as our nemesis and friend, that we thought he was sufficiently dead, that our children would think of him like Lincoln or Thomas Jefferson. Soon it became clear to us, you can't teach disbelief to a child, only wonderful stories. And we hadn't a story nearly as good. On parents' night, there were the arts and crafts all spread out like appetizers. Then we took our seats in the church, and the children sang a song about the ark and hallelujah, and one in which they had to jump up and down for Jesus. I can't remember ever feeling so uncertain about what's comic and what's serious. Evolution is magical, but devoid of heroes. You can't say to your child, evolution loves you. The story stinks of extinction, and nothing exciting happens for centuries. I didn't have a wonderful story for my child. And she was beaming. All the way home in the car, she sang the songs, occasionally standing up for Jesus. There was nothing to do but drive, ride it out, sing along in silence. So Houston's point, one of his main points in this book, is that what religion has done throughout history and can continue to do is tie us into something he called the traditional worldview. And to some way, this traditional worldview is now kind of outdated, but if you can kind of put yourself in there, the traditional worldview says spirit is fundamental and matter is derivative. Form appears in the great ocean of spirit, like icebergs poking up above the surface of the water. In contrast, the scientific worldview, consciousness is limited to a number of clumps of matter in a much larger void. In the traditional worldview, humans are derived from the more. Human beings with all of their talents and flaws are part of something bigger and greater. In the scientific worldview, we are the highest products of evolution. Nothing in science's universe is more intelligent than we are. the traditional worldview has a happy ending. There's no way a happy ending can be worked into the scientific worldview. Death is the grim reaper of individual lives, and whether things, this is a quote from him, whether things as a whole will end in a freeze or a fry with a bang or a whimper is anybody's guess. In the traditional worldview, everything is pervaded with meaning. Life was created by or flows from perfection and is meaningful throughout. In the scientific worldview, any meaning found seems subjectively projected. You know, some people are lucky enough to find meaning in their lives. In the traditional worldview, humans feel at home. They belong to their world, or the world belongs to them, for better or worse. For they are made of the same spiritually sentient stuff that the world is made of. Nothing like this can be derived from the scientific worldview. I mean, think of the bumper sticker, save the planet, kill yourself. And this is why Smith says religion matters. It addresses, it gives us another story, another worldview, tries to convince us of a greater reality, because as even Nietzsche said, he who has a why to live for can bear almost any how. So we can call this greater reality anything we like. Perhaps it makes sense to you to call it God or the divine or that which is greater, other power, the ineffable, the great mystery, the great matter of life and death. But I think you have been touched and experienced it at various times in your life. Houston Smith describes the reality, quote, the reality that excites and fulfills the soul's longing is God by whatsoever name. Because the human mind cannot come within light years of comprehending God's nature, we do well to follow Rainer Maria Rilke's suggestion that we think of God as a direction rather than an object. So it's really clear in other religions, almost all of which are theistic, you know, that the function of the religion is to point to celebrate, to honor, to ally your life with, to subordinate yourself to that which is greater, right? I mean, go to a Christian church and, you know, there it is. It's peaked, it's aiming toward the heavens, there's a reminder of Christ and God, there's an altar, there's hymns and celebrating, and there might be, depending on the denomination, kneeling, or, you know, it's all about that. And in Zen, you know, I mean, we have some statues, but we say, you know, that's your aspiration, you're bowing to your own aspiration. And, you know, we sit and face the wall and we have kind of dry academic talks and reflect on ourselves, and okay. So it's not necessarily obvious that Zen also offers a better story, a story that we can take refuge in. And in a way, we try to abandon all stories, but as human beings, the reality is that we always have some kind of view. We always have some kind of story that we are operating within. That's just the way that our minds work. So this is why I've made this one of my 9 fields, is to kind of remember, you know, Zen does include this and point to it, and it's important that we connect with it. So I hope you will forgive me for quoting myself, because sometimes, I don't know, I just say it so well in writing, I think. I don't. So this is a quote from my podcast episode on Enmo, the Ineffable. We know the ineffable when we encounter it. We know it in our so-called hearts, which can't be located physically in our bodies, but seem to function as sensors attuned to the ineffable. Our hearts swell when we witness incredible acts of compassion, when we hear stories of individuals who dedicated their lives to a noble cause, when we witness awesome spectacles of nature, listen to a beautiful piece of music, join in hearty laughter with a child, or read good poetry.
Personally, I think we perceive the ineffable, or it with a capital I, whenever we look into another person's eyes, which is why it's usually too intense to do that for very long. In these heart moments, it's like the clouds briefly part and the sun shines through. Or for a moment, we remember what's really important. And all of our petty concerns and fears melt away, or at least are put into perspective. For a moment, we are relieved of our skepticism and have a child's open, hopeful, innocent heart. We know love is real, and the beauty of this world is beyond comprehension. We have a sense of who we are, what it means to be human, and why life is worth it. So, I'm so grateful that we do have sources in our Zen tradition that, you know, you have to kind of look for them, but they're there. So this is a quote from Dogen's fascicle Inmo, which essentially means the ineffable, or kind of it with a capital I. So he says, quote, "How do we know that it exists? We know it is so because the body and the mind both appear in the universe, yet neither is ourself. The body already is not I. Its life moves on through days and months, and we cannot stop it even for an instant. The sincere mind, too, does not stop, but goes and comes moment by moment. Although the state of sincerity does exist, it is not something that lingers in the vicinity of the personal self. Even so, there is something which, in the limitlessness, establishes the Bodhi mind." And the Bodhi mind is the mind that seeks the way, seeks liberation, seeks something greater. "Once the Bodhi mind is established, abandoning our former playthings, we hope to hear what we have not heard before, and we seek to experience what we have not experienced before. This is not solely of our own doing." So the Zen approach to that which is greater is very deliberate. We don't talk about it much, or give it a name or image or celebrate it or sing hymns to it, because we're trying to avoid the trap of conceptualizing it. Because when we do, it's there, you know, we lose it to some extent. It could seem as far away as ever. There are many people who have fallen into despair or killed themselves because they had lost the sense of the ineffable, imagining it to be, you know, out there, separate, something they have lost contact with. I mean, for some of us, you know, even the phrase that Houston Smith uses, "The human mind cannot come within light years of comprehending God's nature," is kind of inspiring, but then it seems like God's nature, the ineffable, is something separate from us, outside. So this is called, the Zen approach is called an apophatic approach rather than a cataphatic approach. So this is a term applied in general to religions, that cataphatic means to give a name to describe and celebrate explicitly that which is greater. An apophatic hopes to get you to an experience of it, but by continually telling you what it is not. So it's kind of like, you know, trying to strip away all the things that we are attached to or think it is, so that it is revealed. So as important for our spiritual practice as well as for our mental health to build a relationship with or faith in or sense of the ineffable, or however you want to relate to this. And there's no need to conceptualize it or even put it into words. I mean, really, the more oftentimes I say the ineffable in order, the more uncomfortable I become. You know, do you believe in the ineffable? If you touch the ineffable, you know, I've had a sense of the ineffable last week. Like, it's you know, it starts to drive it away. And this is why Zen teachings, writings, often tend to seem really kind of obscure. And I always have to look it up. Abstruse is the term, you know, kind of like, why can't it be more just, why does it be so unclear? Why can't it just say what it means? But in a way, it's trying to avoid us being able to really grasp onto concepts and terms. So how do we practice in this field? How do we cultivate, you know, connecting with the ineffable? Or I guess there are many different ways, but I think what's most important is to cultivate faith that when we experience those peak moments that I described earlier, that we start to cultivate faith, or at least open to the possibility that is the clouds parting and us experiencing reality. Like, that is reality, not just a nice moment amongst moments. That, you know, that, like, because when we're feeling more bleak and in despair, we're kind of like, yeah, sure, well, that was probably just a little more delusion, you know, that I was happened to feel happy that day. And, you know, we can kind of dismiss them. But if we kind of turn that around and honor that, you know, when we do feel connected like that, when we do feel spacious, that's more real than the dream that we're usually in. And it's not a, you know, Pollyannish attitude that denies the reality of suffering. It's just learning to take a larger perspective that includes everything. From a larger perspective, even the vicissitudes of life are somehow at some level okay. There's still some sense of meaning or order that helps us feel life is worth it. And then, you know, how do we gain more of a sense that we are not actually separate from it? And really, I think that's kind of what all the practices are about. You know, Zazen, Dharma study, cultivating insight, it's all about breaking down this sense of separate self and enduring sense of self that keeps us from feeling like we are more part of all of this. However, I mean, so in some senses, traditional Zen has just been like, yeah, you'll connect with the ineffable, just sit Zazen and do your Dharma study and, you know, keep the precepts and practice mindfulness in everyday life. And, you know, I mean, in a way, we can just entrust ourselves to those practices. If we do them wholeheartedly, it will lead to more of a sense of this. But, you know, the previous field that I talked about was opening the heart and how we can... Similarly, our heart should become more open over the course of practice, but we can also kind of deliberately, consciously work on that with metta practice and stuff. So I think similarly with the ineffable, we can be a little more conscious and deliberate about it. We can just try to recall it more often. And we tend to just forget. That's our nature. We just forget. When we recall that which is greater, I think we don't have to conceptualize it. We can recall images, words, feelings, memories, or aspirations that have arisen in connection with these deep experiences that we've had. I mean, to some extent, it even just be like a physical, kind of a physical posture we take. You know, I don't know, it feels different. Like our heart becomes more central or something. And I kind of picture all of the forms of love that we experience for nature or music or children or whatever, I feel like are just, they're a form of our love for the ineffable. So they can kind of be a doorway in as well, that, you know, one minute you're just kind of sitting there and zazen and like, whatever, you know. But then the next you can sit for the love of your children. Or you can sit, you know, sometimes I sit for the love of my Sangha, that, you know, this is whatever it is that I'm dedicating myself to, doing this will benefit the Sangha, or doing this will make me more able to benefit the planet, which is in such trouble. So then I sit for that, and that to me feels like accessing this in some limited but very effective way. And then we just, I don't know, just maybe turn toward it with a curiosity. What is this? How in what sense are we not separate from it? And, you know, not an intellectual curiosity necessarily, but like, because Dogen, this is also from Inmo, he says, remember, it happens like this. And that is something in this limitlessness establishes this Bodhi mind, this sincere mind. It happens like this because we are people who are it. How do we know we are people who are it? We know that we are people who are it just from the fact that we want to attain the matter which is it. And Houston Smith put that in terms of, oh, I guess I didn't include his quote, but he says something along the lines of, you know, God is, or by whatever name is, there's something in our everyday experience, he says, something that our mundane experience cannot requite in our hearts. So, and he says, the longing for that is like, suggests the existence of that, the way that a bird's wings suggest the existence of air. And Dogen also says, we are tools which the ineffable possesses within this universe in the Ten Directions. So I can go on, but I think you can see how, you know, this does present an encouraging story to see ourselves within, to live out. So I'll leave it there. Questions or comments?
Do you know of any other religions that are
using apophatic?
Yeah. Are there any others that...
I don't know. I really can't think of any.
Native American Shinto?
No, because, I mean, they have spirits.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe, yeah.
What?
Taoism?
Taoism?
Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The Tao
that can be spoken is not a true
Tao, right? Yes, yeah. Although Taoism, it's... I mean, as I understand it, I have a limited understanding, but I don't know that it's been widely practiced as a practical religion in most cases. I think there have been Taoist priests here and there, but... As in, there's not really Taoist churches and, no. You know, that kind of thing.
That brings up the notion, does a religion require edifice and structure?
Well, that's kind of my definition of religion. Religion, because most of the time you define religion by whether it has a god or not, but that doesn't apply to us. So I guess I see it in more practical terms, like there's something essentially culturally transmitted from generation to generation. So maybe you don't have to have a physical place, but you have ways you do things and texts and vocabulary and traditions and clergy or no clergy or, I don't know, rituals and that kind of stuff.
Community.
Huh?
A community.
Yeah, usually. I think, I don't know, that's kind of my definition. You don't have, somebody doesn't just have a religion by themselves. But they might have something, I don't know, I call that spiritual practice. I'm sure, but I don't know. So what I really wanted to do, but I always forget that I want to do this, I really wanted to pass out little slips of paper and a pen just to have everybody take a moment to reflect on ways that they connect with the ineffable. And then not require anybody to share, but encourage people to share. So maybe we could pretend we have paper and pens. And the only reason to do that is just to aid in that reflection, which, you know, for many of us, for many people, you know, an open conversation never gives you a chance to reflect within and answer that question. So how about we take a minute and reflect on, you know, in your life, what makes your heart just, you know, widen and bring you that kind of unmitigated, pure, simple joy, a joy that doesn't make you want to grasp anything more. It's very open-handed. Anybody willing to share? I can start. I definitely feel this when I'm out in the wilderness. I feel this when I am burying my face in Suka's fur. And one of the sweetest moments of this was when some of you will have met Sean Ferris, Marta Ferris's son. And he has Down syndrome, and he used to come to Dharma Rain's children's camp. And somebody would always be assigned to be his buddy throughout the day. And so we'd all do these like 2-hour Sean buddy stints. And so it was one of my stints, and we had just eaten lunch, and we were laying in the grass and looking at the clouds, and Sean's not really, he understands what you say to him, but he's not verbal in the sense of, he doesn't have a conversation with you. I mean, he might answer kind of yes or no, but there's, you know, so you don't really know what he's thinking, and whatever. We were looking up at the clouds, and we looked over at each other, and we just both started to laugh. And just totally crack up, and I just was like, this is, you know, this just doesn't get any better than this. Was that okay?
For me, I think part of the connection is sometimes when I stop, you know, when I'm looking at something and I actually, you know, step back from it, just sort of appreciate it, whatever, it, you know, it's a situation or it's an object or something like that. But if I stop trying to do and make it be something and just be there with it.
Hands down, my what comes to mind is my relationship with my daughter. And her dad and my husband, and just people
and love in my life. I can't sort of get above that. To me, that's it for me.
I'll share. A couple things come to mind for me. Of course, being deep in samadhi after a few days of sesshin, where things said, I just feel supported. There's this sense of being out of time and feeling very supported by everything. Sunsets at the beach, I know it's cliche, but there's that kind of that moment of time where you're just gazing at great beauty. So I think I can see myself on Cannon Beach looking at an amazing sunset, or looking at the alpine glow on Mount Hood, being in the woods and looking at that moment of dusk, where there's just this moment out of time where I kind of go away and just there. And also being with someone who is very ill or near death is, for me, the marker is that moment out of time where there's no place else I'm thinking I need to be, or like everything is just complete and perfect in that moment. I don't know why I've been thinking about this a lot lately, but I was thinking about being in the hospital when Kevin passed, and that was touching the ineffable right there. Just that moment out of time. It was deep grief. And so there can be those moments of touching it, even in the midst of like really intense experiences, I think. So thanks for tackling it.
Watching a wish kit, which is a little bird, in a dry hollow that had been filled with mud. Watching this little bird begin to spin and create a cloud of dust that rises and is surrounding this little bird, and it's just whirling like a top, and this dust is rising up, and there is no sense of time. There is simply this presence of this little bird and the dust and the world, and that's all there is at that point in the world.
Sounds like a poem, maybe some metal. I wake up like 5 or 6 o'clock in the morning, and sometimes it's still dark and nobody else is awake, and I light a candle, I go out into the living room and sit on the couch. It's a beautiful time of the day. It's just quiet, unless there are birds singing, which they are now, and I just open my senses to whatever is happening. Not in a meditation so much as just looking around me, and you know, my senses are, and my skin are awake, and I feel a sense of the ineffable.
Isn't it sweet how, I don't know, as each person describes, I kind of go.
Yeah, like that.
For me, studying science has brought me, you know, many moments. I mean, I think about the Big Bang, well, but before that, you know. And I remember a student had us talking about cells, and the teaching about, you know, all cells come from other cells. And the student says, where did the first one come from? Mm. You know. Those kinds of questions, just the awe of
it. Yeah. I remember looking down a dissecting microscope. I loved dissection. Felt sad about the things I was dissecting. But I would stay after class I would, you know, we'd done, the class is over, and, well, the frog's already dead, so. And I would just gaze and draw at, like, you know, you could study a frog's eye for days. I mean, there's it looks like little gold flakes embedded in the eye. And, I mean, I just, like,
I was in the Rocky Mountains with some friends on a boat in a reservoir, and we went across the reservoir to get tacos and beer. And there was a sudden summer thunderstorm came right up into the mountains, and we're hammering across the lake in this power boat trying to beat the storm back to the dock. You're not going to make it. And these incredible blue sky in the Rockies is being overtaken by these incredible thunderheads, jet black, and the sun is throwing shafts of light on the water, and we're doing as fast as this powerboat can possibly do, bouncing across the lake. And there's this sense of unthinkable wealth, right? So much is pouring into you right then and there. And at the same time, as the bad news is that you don't get to keep any of it, the good news is there's more and more and more and more and more, and you didn't earn any of it, and it never stops. And that's it for me. A really good moment to get that on a motorcycle too. But that's the one that always jumps into my mind first.
For me, I can say there are specific times, but the one that really comes to mind is when I experienced moonset on the beach, at the beach. And it's colors that are very hard to describe, because you're seeing a sunset, but it's the moon that is setting. And the silvers and the lavenders and the deep blues across, you know, the expanse of the sea was just spectacular. And it's just that those very unique natural events for me, very similar to, no, I won't go with that. That's universe. But that's just one. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. I was out in the woods, in the wilderness. And I was probably in my 20s or 30s when I first realized the moon set. And that was a moment of the ineffable, which was like, how can I live on this planet and, like, have missed that? You know, like, how much more am I missing? How much more is there to this infinite world that I'll discover someday?
I'll just go real quick. So yeah, I get it. If I can slow myself down when I'm with my kids, kind of similar to your comment with your daughter, they're 5 and 10, I can slow down my brain enough to listen to them. They're usually asking me some curious questions about, or they want to show me something. If I can slow down for that, that's everything. Mm-hmm. And all the nature stuff too.
Yeah.
But,
yeah. A lot of time, it's not very often, but when I do philosophy, it takes a lot of thinking to really get your mind around something. You have to really work to see what you're thinking about. But then when you come to really grasp something in its whole, it's something that you can't even, like, really talk about. It's the idea that's more than what you've learned. For me, that's that brings on really profound moments.
Sweet, thank you.
For me, it would have to be nature. Yesterday, I took a 5-mile hike, and I just had to stop going so fast because it felt like I was just propelling through this beautiful forest, and
sun was out and the breeze was just so, and it was, I thought I was the luckiest person on this earth. I thought, wow, look at this amazing forest. And sometimes I just have to stop, and I think the feeling of gratitude just washes over me when I'm in that moment. It's like, I get to be here, you know, so that's fine.
Got to be listening to Janis Bach.
Listening to what?
Bach.
Ah.
Any particular piece?
My husband John grew up in the I forget which Lutheran church. He would be disappointed that I forget which Lutheran church it was, because it matters which Lutheran church it was. Augustana Lutheran Church or something. Anyway, he described going, and when you would just arrive like 30 minutes early, and they would be playing Bach on the organ, and that was the meditation. You sat there in the hard wooden pew, and you just listened to the music. And he said that what was there, like a different Bach piece for every single day of the year for the church. So apparently you're not the only one.
For me, it's not experiencing joy. I feel more like a profound sense of peace, that everything is kind of as it should be. I don't have to do anything. I'm kind of a fixer. So what I found is that there are certain moments where, and I can't ever predict, and a lot of times it's in nature, but sometimes it's looking at the wall, or just, I can't ever tell what's going to happen, but what I notice is, after that, I've changed. The really profound moments, things that used to bother me stop bothering me, or things that I used to feel like I have to fix, I can let go of. And so what I notice is it doesn't happen very, very often, but when that kind of sense of peace comes through me, I never know who I'm going to be then. It's like I'm different. It's like I'm always getting to know myself. It's like, you know, they can't say, well, Mom doesn't like that, because when that happens to me, I don't know what I'm in. Like, just changes me a little bit every time. And to me, that's kind of what training is to me. And it's usually changes that I really like, but I didn't do them on purpose. They just happened to me, if that makes sense.
Thank you. Any last person who hasn't gone who wants to go? Well, thank you. That was lovely. So I feel like we should like do this once a month or something. We should, I don't know. Sometimes I'm at a little bit of a loss of how do we kind of celebrate this or bring this to the fore more often. And I think perhaps that's what like Sophia trained at Shasta Abbey, and our lineage came through Shasta, and Roshi Kennett was this, what was the church that she was from? The Church of England, I guess, right? So,
yeah.
So she was, in the West, or the America, it's Episcopalian, so high church, and she translated and interpreted all these Zen stuff, and she would talk about the Lord of the House, and the capital L and capital H, and so she kind of cast this like theistic impression over all of our Zen stuff, which is really weird to read now. You know, if you get used to, you know, the more traditional way Zen is portrayed, which now most Zen centers do, it's kind of like, what is this? But I think that's what she was probably inspired to be trying to convey, that there was something deeper, something more divine, if you will, to point us toward. I'll leave it there. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Oh, wait.
There's more.
All right.
Abiding in this ephemeral world like a lotus in muddy water, the mind is pure and goes beyond. Thus we bow to Buddha. All Buddhas
throughout space and time, all honored ones, Bodhisattvas, Mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, Maha Prajna Paramita.
Enjoy your day.
And we don't need paper and pencil.